Now we're joined by the experts at Vettafi, a new data analytics and thought leadership company that is transforming financial services from an industry to a community, one relationship at a time.
2% of demand versus 1% of demand is a pretty big shift. Energy companies have changed a lot. You know, they're generating significant free cash flow. They're buying back their equity. They're offering attractive dividends.
Stacy, great having you back on the podcast.
It's so great to be with you, Nate. Thanks for having me.
All right. So look, you joined me about 3 months ago, and we talked about how after a stellar 2022, energy had been lagging so far this year. And so I went back and reran some of the numbers over the weekend. And as I'm sure you're aware, energy is currently the worst performing sector in the S&P 500. And not only that, there's an over 40% gap between energy and the top performing sector, which, of course, is tech. And so to start this week, I'd love to have you just talk about what's been going on with energy over the past 3 months, and has anything meaningfully changed since we last spoke?
Yeah, I mean, there have been some changes. I think, you know, more broadly, it feels like energy and tech move in opposite directions. Last year, you know, let's not forget that energy did really well and tech was not great. But now, you know, tech has the hot hand and energy is bumping. But when we talked last, energy wasn't doing so bad. It was lagging, but it wasn't bad. And that was kind of the calm before the storm. Oil prices were remarkably steady between $75 and $80 a barrel from about mid-November to early March when we talked. And then, you know, in mid-March, you had the banking crisis really come to the forefront. And that set off significant fears about the economy, a recession, and just led to risk-off sentiment in the market, which put pressure on oil prices and on energy stocks as well. So you actually saw broader energy trade pretty in line with banks, which was kind of interesting. You know, energy companies generally had a good earnings season. Producers are still making good money at these commodity prices. But the macro concerns have really been dominating how the equities trade.
You mentioned the banking crisis. Can you talk a little bit more about how that regional banking crisis has impacted some energy stocks? Because I'm not sure that that's necessarily an intuitive connection for some investors. Does it come down just to potential contagion there and concerns over the economy as a whole, or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is largely concerns about the economy. I mean, both are cyclical, both are value-oriented, and they're sensitive to the outlook for the economy. And I think, you know, there was an element of concern that the banking crisis would tip us into a recession, which would be bad for oil prices and bad for energy. You know, for energy stocks, the concern is, you know, what may happen to oil demand and therefore oil prices if we do see a recession. And so, you know, you saw that similarity. I think it was surprising to a lot of investors, but it is largely because they're both sensitive to the outlook for the economy.
Stacy, if we drill down a little bit, has there been anything within the energy space that is working? I know last time you highlighted MLPs and an ETF like the Alerian MLP ETF, ticker AMLP. I believe we also talked oil services, so an ETF like the VanEck Oil Services ETF, ticker OIH. But again, I looked over the weekend. AMLP is certainly still hanging in there performance-wise, but OIH is now down about 15% year-to-date. So is it just MLPs that are actually performing now?
Yeah, so in short, it is MLPs that are really kind of the bright spot in the energy complex. If you look at what happened with oil field services, you know, the bull story kind of when we talked earlier this year was that, you know, these companies were seeing strong demand for their services and their margins were expanding. You know, most energy sectors were expected to see a worse 2023, mainly because of lower commodity prices and because of just how strong 2022 was. But oil field services was unique in that they were actually expected to see kind of a positive rate of change for earnings this year. So this oil field service space actually started the year pretty well, and then oil field services got hit when oil prices sold off on the banking crisis. So much like oil and gas producers, oil field service companies can be sensitive to what happens with the commodity. And then also, if you fast forward a bit to, you know, earlier this month on 1Q earnings calls, you had producers talking about how well costs were starting to plateau. So the kind of bull case for oil field service, unfortunately, got kind of caught up in the weakness in commodity prices, and now oil field services are, you know, underperforming energy broadly, if you look at like the XLE, for example. On the other hand, you know, MLPs have been resilient. Again, really kind of the only energy space with portion of the energy space with notable gains. The Alerian MLP Infrastructure Index, which underlies AMLPU that you mentioned, it's up about 7% on a total return basis year to date through Friday. And some of that has to do with the fact that these companies are operating fee-based businesses. They generate more stable cash flows. Midstream names were expected to largely see modest EBITDA growth this year instead of EBITDA declines like other energy sectors. But that total return number also benefits from generous MLP yields, which were at right at 8% as of Friday. So that's helped. And then earlier this month, MLPs got a boost when OneNote announced that it was acquiring Magellan Midstream Partners. The deal there included a 22% premium, and Magellan tends to be a large name in MLP indexes, so it saw a nice, you know, kind of pop on that announcement. And then some other MLPs also traded up in kind of sympathy after that announcement. So MLPs were outperforming before the Magellan OneOak deal was announced, but that performance difference between broader energy has become kind of more pronounced over the last couple of weeks following that deal announcement.
Yeah, and just for comparison, you mentioned AMLP up about 7% this year. I should have noted this earlier. So the Energy Select Sector Spider ETF, ticker XLE, which I was obviously referencing in terms of the energy sector in the S&P 500, that's down 9% year-to-date. Of course, the S&P 500, an ETF like SPY, that's up a little over a 10% total return. Stacey, with MLPs in particular, you know, I just noted the S&P 500. Some investors may not be aware that MLPs aren't in the S&P 500. And so if you want exposure, you may have to go out and get it, right? And so I'd love to have you explain why that might make sense. And I get that MLPs are having a pretty good year this year. So, you know, that alone may make some sense. But give me the case for proactively tracking down MLP exposure in a portfolio. Why own this from more of a longer term standpoint?
Yeah. I mean, you're exactly right. If you want to own this space, you kind of have to go out and look for it. It's probably not something you're going to get exposure to otherwise. But MLPs are usually excluded from broad market indexes because they issue K-1s for tax purposes. And so that tax treatment is what kind of keeps them out of those indexes, but it's also what can make MLPs very desirable. They're pass-through entities, they pay generous dividends, and a portion of those dividends are typically tax-deferred. So most people come to the MLP space for that tax-advantaged income. And, of course, people can consult with their tax advisor for more details on that. But, you know, the tax-advantaged income and the potential for tax deferral of that income is, you know, the primary benefit and the main reason that people are usually attracted to this space. But there's other benefits as well. As you mentioned, it's not in these broad market indexes, so there's some diversification benefits. MLPs tend to have a lower correlation with other income investments like utilities and bonds. So not only can you enhance the yield of an income portfolio, I mentioned MLPs yielding about 8%, but you know, it also offers some good diversification to some of your other kind of income standbys. And then it's also a good space for people who are worried about inflation. These companies provide real asset exposure. Their contracts typically include annual inflation adjustments. So this is a space that we can, you know, see do well when we have high inflation like we saw in 2021 and 2022. And then finally, it's also more defensive energy exposure. So people will look to MLPs or midstream if they want energy exposure, but maybe they're worried about commodity prices or they're worried about a recession and they want to be, you know, a little more defensively positioned. So to kind of sum that up, you know, the tax advantage income is usually what people come to the MLP space for, but there are other benefits as well and other ways that you can use it in portfolios.
Yeah, and of course, we're obviously seeing that more defensive energy position out of MLPs this year. It's the perfect example. Again, I mentioned XLE down, you know, whatever, 9%. Well, an ETF like AMLP is up 7%. If we look more broadly at the energy ETF space, besides MLP ETFs and then, say, OIH, which I mentioned, and XLE, are there any other energy-related ETFs that are standing out to you this year, whether good or bad?
Yeah, I would say there's not a lot really standing out. The strength is actually fairly isolated to the MLP space. Even if you look at RIC compliant ETFs that are typically 25% MLPs and 75% midstream C corps, those are more flattish this year. The underlying index for the Alerian Energy Infrastructure ETF, ticker ENFR, is down 1% on a total return basis through Friday. So you're still seeing broader midstream, outperform broader energy as represented by the XLE, but it's still, not as strong or as maybe compelling a story as what we're seeing from MLPs so far.
Yeah, and I still can't get over that performance gap that I mentioned earlier. I know it's a little cliche, and to your point that, typically when tech performs really well, perhaps energy isn't, but you look at an ETF like XLK, that's up over 32% this year, just for comparison. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens the remainder of the year. There's a lot of talk right now just about the top heaviness of some of the broad indexes and mega cap growth leading the way. It'll just be interesting to see what happens on the energy side of the equation. And I guess on that note, let's spend a few minutes looking forward like we always do and discuss the outlook for oil and natural gas prices, because of course those prices can help drive energy related ETFs. And so I'm curious, as you look at both of those, give us a quick snapshot. What are you watching for? What could be some key drivers the rest of the year?
Yeah, so from an oil perspective, in the near term, we'll be looking for updates out of the OPEC Plus meeting on June 4th. Last week, Saudi's energy minister was sending signals and warnings to speculators and implying that they may do a cut, but then Russia was talking down the potential of more cuts. So we'll keep an eye on things there from an OPEC Plus perspective. Also keeping an eye on demand trends, looking for any signs of weakness due to the economy or even, surprise pockets of strength coming out of China, coming from international travel, those sorts of things. And then, so far this year, Russian exports have been really resilient. So that's the other kind of variable to keep an eye on. I think those have surprised to the upside. But big picture for this year, I think people expect the market to get tighter as the year goes on and as we get into 2024, barring, a severe recession. So I think that's what we'll kind of be looking for and seeing if that plays out. On the natural gas side, may get some help if we see a hot summer here, but the general view is that natural gas probably doesn't get better until we start to see some LNG export capacity come online next year in the U.S. The natural gas rig count in the U.S. has come down lately, so producers are responding to lower prices, which is what they should be doing. So that can help kind of directionally in terms of kind of cleaning up the supply-demand picture there. But generally, people aren't too constructive on natural gas until we get into kind of next year. So that's kind of, things to keep watching for. I think big picture, both oil and natural gas have the potential to kind of get better from here. But I think in the near term, we're probably going to see some more volatility just given ongoing headlines in the energy space. So I guess I would say I'm a little cautious on the near term and then more constructive as time goes on.
I try to learn something new from you every time you're on this podcast. And of course, we just wrapped up Memorial Day weekend. The summer's now kicked off. And you mentioned with nat gas that maybe a really hot summer could help prices. I feel like that's something investors may see in the news and in headlines. Like, how big of a driver could that really be? If we have a brutally hot summer, how much could that impact demand on the nat gas side?
I mean, it can help a lot in terms of kind of working down inventories and just cleaning things up a little bit because we have been so oversupplied. I think we may have talked about it. This winter was surprisingly warm, and that really put a quick damper on natural gas prices. They went from, well over $5 in kind of November, December to, falling below $2. So if we see, a really hot summer, I think that can help. But it's also kind of coming into the summer with high inventories, ample supply, ample production. So it would have to probably be pretty hot to see a really significant price move in natural gas.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. I prefer things to be a little more mild than the 100 degree heat, especially with where I'm at. Stacy, just a few minutes left before I let you go. You heard at the top, I'll be visiting here momentarily with Alexandra Russo from Candrium, and we are going to talk ESG, which of course the E in ESG stands for environmental and gets into things like the carbon footprint of companies. Now, full disclosure, I know you and I could do literally an entire podcast or two on this topic, but I haven't asked you before. And so I'm just curious how you view this initiative to transition to net zero and the potential longer term impact to the traditional energy companies that you and I discuss. Do you view ESG initiatives as sort of a threat to the traditional energy sector?
Well, so to your point, there's a lot to unpack here. I'll try to keep it brief. But I think what you mentioned at the top of the show is really important, is that you have to kind of ground this in a practical discussion and what's really happening. So I think renewables and alternative energy are going to play a growing role in the energy mix. There will be a lot more solar and wind power generation, more electric vehicles, and I think we can probably all agree on that to some degree. But I think where everybody disagrees is the timeline for these events and just when and how much fossil fuel demand will decline. If you look at 2021, so pre the invasion of Ukraine, fossil fuels accounted for 82% of global primary energy use. And fossil fuels have been about 80% of the global energy mix for decades. So renewables are growing, and they're growing tremendously, but it's off of a low base. So to this point, we haven't really seen a significant displacement of fossil fuels because just total global energy use has been growing. And I really like to use coal as an example. I would guess most people don't realize that coal consumption in 2021 was the highest that it's been since 2014, or that coal accounts for about 36% of global power generation. Coal is still a huge part of our energy mix, even though it's by far the most villainized fossil fuel. So I think the resiliency of coal demand just shows that switching energy sources is not quick, it's not easy. And broadly, the world continues to face what people call this energy trilemma. And that's essentially the need for secure, affordable, and low carbon energy. So to me, if the world is going to solve that problem globally, it's not just the U.S. or Europe problem, right? We also have to think about people in developing countries. I think we're going to need both alternative energy and fossil fuels produced in a more responsible manner. And I think we're going to need those fossil fuels produced in a responsible manner for years and years. So to your question, yes, ESG and net zero are a threat to traditional fossil fuels over time. But I think people tend to overestimate the timing and the magnitude of that threat. And we should also note that, energy companies are focused on ESG as well. There are a handful of midstream companies, for example, that have net zero targets by 2050. So, energy companies are not aloof to what's going on. And several of them are investing in alternative energies. And I think people tend to kind of forget that.
I'm really glad. Yeah, sorry. I'm actually glad that you mentioned that last point, because I've talked a lot about this, that if you look at a company, say, like, Exxon, they are making an effort in this space, and they are looking at alternatives to traditional fossil fuels. And I think there's a number of energy companies that are trying to lead the charge here. But to your point, this transition doesn't happen overnight. And I just always find it interesting that you have companies in the energy space that are working on renewables that are actually excluded from ESG ETFs and ESG indexes. It's just such an interesting thing to me. But I don't want to put words in your mouth. It sounds like, in summary, and I know you're not here to make investment calls, but you don't really see this as a huge threat to the traditional energy sector. If I'm an investor proactively allocating to, an ETF like XLE, it doesn't sound like you see this as any sort of big threat, at least in the short to intermediate term. Is that fair?
Yeah, I would say I don't think it's a threat in the short term. I think it is a longer term threat. But if you are investing in something like that, it just bears mentioning that Exxon is huge in carbon capture. Chevron is making investments in, you know, hydrogen and renewable fuels, Exxon also. So these companies are doing a lot on that front. It just doesn't tend to get noticed. And so from that standpoint, yes, I don't think it's, you know, something that an XLE investor needs to be worried about today.
Well, Stacy, always a pleasure. I know I say this every time, but nobody covers the energy space better than you do. Thank you for joining me this week.
No, thanks for having me, Nate. It's always a pleasure.
That was Stacy Morris, head of energy research at Vettafi.